Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, and everybody managed to snap up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb to help the economy at the behest of our Prime Minister John Key, who used to work for the Federal Reserve on Wall Street. It's a small, small world we live in, isn't it? Especially when there's only 4 million people in your country. My very special guest right now is the owner of a pig farm called Baker's Green Acres. I've forgotten his name already. Welcome to the show, mate, whoever you are.
Hey, how you doing, Vinny? This is Mark Baker.
Mark Baker. All right. I'm glad to have you with us, my good pal and chum and various other nice adjectives. Colleague Pam Killeen recommended, demanded that I get you on the show. And I very rarely watch videos or do any research on my guests. Your video I did watch about what's happening with your pig farm there. So I probably can't explain it quite as well as you could. So, Mark, go ahead.
Well, let's see. My farm is not just a pig farm. We raise beef, pork, and chicken, and then we do produce, and we also do some educational classes and things like that. What happened was in 2011, December time frame, we were told that the state of Michigan, I'm here in the USA, state of Michigan was declaring war on feral pigs. And then they gave a description of what a feral pig looks like. They gave 9 characteristics. And the pigs that I raise, they're a heritage breed. They happen to be called Mangalitsa pigs. They come out of Hungary. Those pigs had at least 6 of the characteristics, and it's debatable maybe there was 7 or 8 of them. And so I contacted the state agency that had declared war on them, and I said that, gee, my pigs have those characteristics, but clearly my pigs are not feral, and there must be some mistake. And they said, well, there's going to be a meeting in Grayling, Michigan, which is 2 hours from me, in February of 2012, and you could go to that and get things straightened out. So I did go to that, and there was probably 50 other farmers there, and we were met at the door by an armed officer, and there was 2 more armed officers in the room, and we were pretty much told to sit down and shut up and listen to the briefing that they gave, and they told us that if we wanted to bring pictures of our animals they would let us know if we could keep them or not. And I didn't bring any pictures of my animals. But we were given this briefing, and then they didn't allow any questions. They told us that we would just have to comply with the regulation, and if we had pigs that were feral, that we needed to depopulate our pigs by the first day of April of 2012. What I did was, I'm former military, I'm former U.S. military. I decided that the order that they had given was not constitutional, and therefore it was an unlawful order, illegal order, and I chose to not follow the order. And I told them that I would not follow it. And if they wanted to arrest me, then they would have to do that. So April 1st came and went. We sent all the children away from the farm, sent my wife away from the farm, because my state has a pretty good reputation of armed raids on farms. And they didn't show. They didn't show up. And we are in a court case with them now, and the stakes have elevated. There's a lot of people that are on our side because they realize the implications of this. And for your listening audience, I just want to say this is really not about pigs. This is about personal property rights. You know, if the state can declare something is illegal at any point, then really none of the possessions that we have are safe from the state if they choose to declare it illegal, whether it's unsafe or whatever like that.
You'll love this, then. In New Zealand, they're talking about making domestic cats illegal.
Well, you know, they should, Vinny, really, because I'm in the state of Michigan, and you probably know Detroit is not doing too well these days because of the auto industry. It's pretty well shut down. And people leave Detroit, and they leave their animals behind, like their dogs. And the dogs become feral, and they've got a tremendous feral dog problem in Detroit. Well, by the same way of thinking, you know, if they're going to go after farms, thinking that we're the source of feral pigs, then they should probably go after homeowners who have pet dogs and say, we need to get rid of all those because they could become feral.
You know, see, me personally, I think that the pigs in uniform are the feral ones most of the time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You know, they've really strayed from where we came from, the land of the free and the home of the brave.
So you also had an element within your video where you explained how the Soviet Union tried to control food in such a way.
Well, what I was explaining, I was trying to draw a parallel between the blockade of Berlin after World War II and the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is now blockading my farm, right? They don't want a fair fight with us. So what they've done, you know, we're willing to go to court with them and have a judge hear it, maybe a jury of our peers, and decide whether what they're doing is fair or not. So they've put it off and put it off and put it off, and now we're told that it will be until next November that we get to go to court with them. So then what they did is they made it very difficult for us to ship animals because I have to go through a local veterinarian to get a health certificate in order to ship the animals from state to state. And they've leaned on the veterinarians to identify our pigs as feral, and therefore we cannot ship them across state lines. And some vets have complied with the state and some have not. And the ones that have not are also locked up with the state now in legal wrangling. Then the next thing that they did was they went to the slaughtering facilities where we would take pigs, because if we're going to take pigs from the farm to a slaughtering facility, I don't need any health certificate, because at the slaughtering facility they have a veterinarian there and they say whether the animal's healthy or not. And the veterinarians at the slaughtering facilities are not allowing animals in that they say are feral, and they base that feralness on a description. And if we were to look up feral in Webster's dictionary, we'd see that a feral pig or a feral animal or a feral child is one that is not under the direct husbandry or supervision of human beings. So there's no way that a pig that's on my farm that I'm shipping could be feral, but yet the state has given these veterinarians at the slaughter facilities a new description of the word feral. You know, the whole thing is very, very Marxist. They are trying to confuse people and keep us off balance with, you know, this, you know, whether it's a pig with a floppy tail or a pig with a straight tail. But bottom line, a pig that is raised under the husbandry of human beings cannot be feral by definition, so it shouldn't happen. So anyway, the blockade is I can't move my animals to slaughter, and I can't sell them across state lines. So I am effectively blockaded. And I was trying to draw a parallel between, you know, what's happening on our farm and what happened during the blockade of Berlin after World War II, where the Soviets would not allow Allied troops to bring food in to the people of Berlin. And they wanted the people of Berlin to rely on the Soviet Union for their food and therefore, you know, be under their control. And so what the Allies did was they got together and they started flying supplies in. It's called the Berlin Airlift. And I've called on my friends to help me out, to help us through this blockade until we can get to the court. And so far, the American people have risen to the occasion, and we still have all of our animals, or most of them, and we're still feeding them and still carrying on our farming operation, which is, I think it's paramount, because if the state can choke us out and we, you know, we're forced to sell the farm and move to town, then I don't have any standing in a court of law, and I think that's what they want. You know, they're not, they're definitely bullies. They're not playing fair, for sure.
You're aware, Mark, of the Agenda 21 program, right?
How's that? Can you say that again?
Are you aware of the Agenda 21 program to get all the local farmers and stuff like that off the land?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know about that. When this first started, I had people telling me, oh, this is Agenda 21, and, you know, I didn't know anything about it, and I thought, well, you know, this is another conspiratorial type thing, and I just said, I don't have time for that. You know, we just need to get these idiots out of our way. But as time has gone by, I've had to go and look at the Agenda 21 document, and I still have people on my side that are saying, no, it isn't Agenda 21, and ignore that. But it really is, because, like, in our case, they call it the declaratory ruling, by the way, and it's the invasive species order. That came up under a previous administration in the state of Michigan. We had a Democrat governor. And when the Republicans took over, this was a controversial issue, and not good. It's not good for a new governor to have controversial issues on his desk when he takes office. And normally what they do is they just push him in the wastebasket. It's like, we don't want to deal with this. But the Republican governor that took over, his name is Rick Schneider, took this issue on and even appointed somebody to ramrod it and make it happen. So I now believe that he is doing this because to break step with Agenda 21 is political suicide, not from the constituency of the citizenry of the United States, but from the controlling powers that want to make Agenda 21 reality. So, yeah, I would have to say that I do believe at this point this is Agenda 21.
And have you had any offers by major corporations to, you know, take the farm off your hands and make this all easy for you?
No, I haven't. No, but
if you did have a big offer, would you take it?
Well, that's a hypothetical question. I never faced that yet. No, I don't think I would. I don't think I would because I'm former military and I took an oath to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. That's what I plan to do.
Yeah, and that includes private property, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It wouldn't be much of a country if it was run by the corporations.
Well, I guess it is run by the corporations at the moment. Yeah, there's just kind of a little bit of wiggle room in there.
Yeah, they are taking control, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a real problem, don't you think, that when you try to make a living, you try to be honest, you try to be decent, and the people who you think are supposed to actually, you know, enforce the law and protect rights and that kind of thing, law enforcement, courts, government, essentially, sometimes you realize that actually they're the ones trying to break the law, even though they're the ones passing it, and they're the criminals who need to be arrested. I was just thinking about this before coming on the air today. What if a cop came up to me and tried to arrest me for no good reason? And I said to him, look, mate, you're breaking the law right now, and I'm going to arrest you. I'd actually have to physically overpower the guy, but you can't. You just taser me.
Yeah.
It's a real sad situation, man.
I don't think they've achieved their goal yet because... And here's why I think that they haven't gotten there yet. I think there's still a lot of hope. It's because people are starting to understand what's going on more and more and more. Shows like this are on all the time. And it really doesn't take a whole lot of people to dig their heels in and say no. Because when one guy does, then another guy does, and then another, and so on. And I'm from New England. I'm from Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. That's where I grew up. And as a young guy, you're taught about the revolution over and over and over. And just recently, just a week ago, I was back to New England, and I went to the North Bridge, and I got to see where the shot heard around the world was fired. And in researching that whole time in our American history, you know, you realize that this isn't the first time that American citizens have been lulled to sleep and tried to...
We'll be right back. No one's gonna take me alive. The time has come to make things right. You and I must fight for our rights. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery and people trying to steal everything that you've got, even though they don't frickin' deserve it, with a sense of entitlement, if you lose your sense of humour, you go frickin' nuts. My very special guest is, I believe it's Mark Baker from Baker's Green Acres, and we're talking about how, essentially, they're trying to stop him from selling his pigs off, which is kind of just total breach of the Constitution. And I'm acting under the assumption that there's an awful lot of police status type measures or sort of like weird court instances, you know, where you'll go to court and it's just you, but for some reason there's an awful lot of armed people around. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I think you're referring to a court case that we had in Sheboygan. This was last March, and I showed up at the courthouse at 8 o'clock. We were scheduled for 9, and we were kind of amazed that we had to walk through metal detectors on the way in. Now, Sheboygan is a real small town, and that time of year, there's hardly anybody there. So it's not like being in a big city where, you know, there's a lot of bad things going on. Nothing happens in Sheboygan. So we walked in, and we had to go through metal detectors. There was several sheriff's department guys standing there, and then there was four state policemen, and then there was these other guys that were there that were in civilian clothes, and they were all tattooed up and beards and everything. But and they were standing apart, but then I noticed they'd stand close enough that they could talk to each other, and I looked them over real good, and I could tell that they were carrying weapons, and they had bulletproof jackets on and all that stuff. So there was five of them, and when we were in the courtroom, there was at least two of those guys within 6 feet of me at all times. Now, we're just farmers. I'm 52 years old, so I don't think I present, you know, a terribly menacing image. And the other guys that I'm in this court case with, they're in their 60s. So, and we were disarmed going in, so I don't think we weren't there to duke it out at the OK Corral. If we were, I don't think we would have gone to court. But we counted at any one time in the courtroom at least 8 guns. The people from the Department of Natural Resources, there were 17 of them, and there was at least 6 armed at all times. So, yeah, that was an enlightening experience. Oh, yeah, and a bomb dog, too. That was kind of interesting. All for pigs, right?
Yeah, maybe they were afraid they were carrying a swine flu bomb or something.
Maybe. Hey, you know, I got cut off before. And the point that I want to make is we spend a lot of time complaining about this, and then we go to the people who are taking our liberties away, and we say, hey, don't do this. And that it's not working, because they're not, you know, if they're going to take your liberties from you, they're not about to stop taking your liberties just because you say you want them to stop
yeah.
taking.
There's not an or else that they have to be afraid of, is there?
Well, I think my experience in this has been these people are cowards, and they're relying on citizens to just say, okay, and then, you know, go watch TV. But I think if people are concerned about their liberties being taken away, they need to be willing to just dissent and do what they know is right, and then pay the consequences. And if that means that you're going to get arrested, so be it. Then you go to court, you have a jury of your peers, and that's the way that goes. Now, I'm former military, did 20 years in the Air Force, and I know how things work. If you're given an order that is illegal and unlawful, your duty is to not carry that order out, or to refuse an unlawful order. And then you would be court-martialed, and there would be people there that are your peers, and they would decide whether what you did was proper according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's what we're under in the military, or not proper. And if you are court-martialed, you know, I think a lot of people think a court-martial is your worst enemy. But in reality, if you're given an order, let's say you're given an order to shoot civilians, and you refuse to carry that order out, the person that gave you that order, they're the ones that will hang, not you. Now, in this case, I've been ordered to shoot my pigs, and I've refused that order. And so we're saying, let's go to court. Now, we're going to find out who gave that order, and if it's an unlawful order, I will not be held accountable for refusing an unlawful order. But the person who gave that order, they will be held accountable. And they cannot do that. They cannot order us to depopulate our animals based on, you know, the fact that our animals are feral, because they're obviously not. So we're not done here, you know, and I think we've taken the right course of action in refusing an unlawful order.
Now, in terms of other tactics and things like that, have they done anything else to you other than bring you into court or anything? You said that they haven't raided the property or anything, have they?
No, not directly. One night, my 15-year-old son came in the house wild-eyed. We live out in the perimeter quite far, and there's no one around us. And he came in wild-eyed, and he said, "There are men in the woods." And so at the time, I happened to have a broken leg. I went down there as quickly as I could to where I could see them. And sure enough, there was two individuals in the wood line that were approaching our animals. And they were definitely on our property. And so I went back to the house. I got my pickup truck and a phone and a flashlight. And I raced out the driveway. By the time I got to the bottom of the driveway, they were at the corner, but I could see them pretty good, and it was a newer black SUV, like a Suburban or something like that, and I couldn't catch them. They were really moving, and I'm not sure whether they were just trying to draw me off or what, but when we called the sheriff's department, they didn't show up for an hour, and then the sheriff wasn't interested in pursuing it at all. They just said that, well, it was probably just kids, you know, looking for a place to take a leak or something like that. But I don't buy that at all. I think it was definitely people from one of these organizations that was coming in just to probe us and see what
our reaction. My first assumption is the FBI trying to scare you or intimidate you into stopping doing what you're doing.
Yeah, probably just to see what we'd do. And then the next thing that was a little bit over the top, I thought, was, again, it happened that it was 10:30 at night. My oldest daughter and I, she's 11, we went out to the pigs to shut the water off. This is in the summertime. The sun's up quite high until 9:30, so this was just getting dark. And a platform, it looked like a helicopter. You know, we couldn't really see it. We could just see the light on it. It was coming towards us at a very strange angle. And we just stood there and watched it, expected to hear the noise, you know, from the rotors. But there was absolutely no noise. And it came right over our swine area, our pig area. No noise at all. And there was one red navigational light on it that was on the top, and then we could see the propellers on the top of it, and it was some sort of platform, and then it kind of swiveled around and kind of as if it was looking at us, and we were just standing there looking at it, and then it went off and gained altitude and went out of sight. And I mentioned it to a friend of mine that's up on stuff like that, and he said it was a drone, and sure enough, I got on the internet and I found something that looked similar to it. So that was another thing that they did, and we thought maybe they just wanted to get a count on our animals to make sure that we weren't shipping them off.
See, this is the kind of thing that you'd expect in a George Orwell novel, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually think these people are using the George Orwell 1984 as an instructional guide. I think they think that's what they should do. But, you know, again, I got to tell you, I don't think these people are very courageous people. You know, how many stones does it take to fly a drone over a farmer's place? Or, you know, send in a couple guys to probe the place and then just run out. They don't want to go head-to-head with us in court because they'll lose. And I don't know. These are state employees. You know, they're just doing what they're told. They all want to go home and enjoy their lives. I don't think they really want to do this. They're being pushed to do this by by big agriculture is who's putting them up to it.
How do you know it's big ag putting them up to it?
Well, because we conducted depositions in the August time frame. And the Department of Natural Resources has cited two individuals as their experts in creating the declaratory ruling. One guy's name is Dr. Bates, and the other guy's name is Mr. Guthrie. And we deposed these individuals, put them on the stand under oath, The whole thing was recorded and videoed. I have the transcripts of it, and I was in the room when it happened. And both individuals stated that they knew that they were cited as experts on this case by the Department of Natural Resources, but they both said they didn't know why. Because as far as they knew, they had been invited to a feral swine working group, and they were invited by a man by the name of Sam Hines. And Sam Hines is the vice president of the Michigan Pork Producers Association, which is a lobbying group that lobbies for the huge agribusiness firms that you know, have these big hog houses where there's 5,000 pigs in a house, and they stink the neighborhood up, and they create pork that's unhealthy to eat. They have to use a bunch of stuff to make them grow and all that stuff. I think you know what I'm talking about. And
yeah.
So the Feral Swine Working Group in the state of Michigan was created by Michigan pork producers. And when we looked further into that, we found that there was documentation, and I have this documentation, that shows that the Michigan pork producers were supported by several other entities. One was Michigan Milk Producers, another one was Michigan Poultry, Michigan Soy, Michigan Corn, Greenstone Farm Credit Services. They're the guys that hold the money. You know, they get federal dollars, and then they decide who they're going to loan it out to. So like a small farmer like me that's diversified, kind of like your grandpa's farm, they don't loan money to guys like me. They'll only loan guys that are money to guys that are doing the what they call CAFO systems, and that's concentrated animal feeding operations. And that is very much Agenda 21 orientated, because in Agenda 21, they want all animals what they call under roof, and that means they're, you know, basically raised inside like you house prisoners. So that's how I know that agribusiness is behind this.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens. I think large corporations, they lobby government so that they can wipe out the smaller competitions through use of force. So, you know, that's basically what's going on here. Unfortunately, we're coming very close to the end of this interview now, and you're asking for help and donations, even restaurants to give you scraps and everything like that. If you could give out your websites and locations where people could do that, I'd be much obliged.
Yeah, thanks. My website is bakersgreenacres.com, and our phone number's on there and all that stuff. Yeah, that'd be real helpful.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, understand that this is probably not just happening to this lovely man here. This is probably happening all over the place. And I think that what you said earlier is, well, basically it usually just takes one person to stand up and then other people start standing up. So, you know, it's pretty important to support the people who are actually putting it on the line and not backing down. And I salute you for what you're doing, mate.
Thanks, Vinny.
Okay.
Thank you. So I got another minute?
We've got about 20 seconds, 30 seconds.
All right. Well, I just got to say that these guys are so powerful that they have found a way into the court system. And you're not only fighting these big entities, you're also fighting the court system too.
All right. Mark Baker from bakersgreenacres.com. If you are anywhere near the area, or if you have any spare cash or food scraps or something of that nature, please go to the website, contact them via phone or email. The details are right there, and give him the support that he needs so he can continue this fight against the monopolistic forces of scumbaggery in America. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
The world we knew is gone.
Yeah, the world we knew is gone. Welcome back.
The conditions which framed the...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show. Final segment of the first hour here. We have a very special guest. I believe it's Peter Stevens on the line.
G'day, Vinny.
G'day, mate. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do, mate?
Certainly. I've been involved with inventions in Australia for, I don't know, 50 years. And some of the things that I was involved with was through the Inventors Association as a publicity officer. And I met a number of inventors whom I've helped, one of whom had come up with a rainmaker by the name of Jack Toya. And I met Jack in 1985, and when he passed away in the early 90s, I was asked by the family if I would continue some of his research and do that sort of thing. And I was sucked into it. That's the only way to put it. So I started rainmaking until 1994, when I went to the annual general meeting of the cotton growers out at Moree, and they told me they didn't want rain. Subsequently, 12 years later, I got asked by an ex-Commonwealth magistrate if I would put the machine back together, please, and have a go at doing it. Does it work? And can you do it? So I indicated that I possibly could, and in 2006, I've got to go to some amazing places around the world, and it's rained every time we've been anywhere. So that's just roughly what's going on.
So you're kind of like one of the moisture farmers on Tatooine off Star Wars.
Sorry?
You're kind of like one of the moisture farmers on Tatooine off of Star Wars.
thank you. Yeah, possibly. We were looking at the science of what we're doing, and it looks like Dr. Walter Russell and Leo Russell were the ones that perceive what we're doing in their science of atomic suicide and universal one. So, written about in 1921 and also 1957. So what we're able to do is pretty amazing. So I've been to America and had it rain there a couple of times, including places like Death Valley where it doesn't normally rain. And Phoenix, Arizona, that was a lot of fun. So a little bit of excitement down in Florida as well, and over in Waynesboro, Virginia, where we said g'day to Walter and just said thank you for the acknowledgement of the science. So we put a little bit of water into Raleigh in North Carolina so that they didn't have to evacuate the city in the middle of the drought. So a little bit of fun.
So just recently, Australia has suffered these massive bushfires, which, as far as I've found out, were actually caused by the government banning the collection of firewood and stopping the normal burn-offs that they do to keep all the scrub and tinder down on the forest floors and stuff like that at down. And you told me that you'd be helping that out by creating a bit of rain for them. And then I hear on the news that there were these massive Queensland floods. Were you the bastard who pulled them off?
G'day, Benny. Sorry, I couldn't hear that. What was that? Mate, we were out there. We were doing it. We were out at Burke on the 10th of January until the 20th. And we had the machine running for that period of time. The possibility of storms, we certainly helped put out the fires. When I spoke to the Rural Fire Service, the manager at Grafton indicated to me it might be a really nice idea, as the water was now just 40 millimetres from the top of the levee, would I mind turning it off? But we assisted by putting the fires out. As far as I'm aware, that's what our intention was, and it certainly happened. The other cyclone that came down the Queensland coast may have been a result of what we were doing, but it wasn't our intention to cause that. But
so
it did
So there's consequences to the use of this machine.
Well, you will get wet. We're 100% accurate in that. The amount of rain that you get is something that's still in debate. But we've had unlikely events like snow in Baghdad as a result of some of what we've done. We fired into the Mediterranean on the 8th of January 2008, and within 3 days we had rain through Libya, flooding in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and followed by snow in Baghdad. Had never snowed in Baghdad in living memory. But one of the results of some of what we do is that we do get snow on the mountains in unlikely times, or, you know, a typhoon is normally, according to the Chinese, somewhere in late June, July. We actually had one form in April, which is a little bit ahead of time, but not, you know, throughout history it's been shown that it's happened. But it's just unusual that when we're involved, and we're only flicking light with electromagnetics and high static charges back up into the atmosphere. So we're reflecting sunlight. So we start with blue sky, and within several hours, we normally have a cloud bank build up around us and followed by rain. Out at Burke, it lasted for close to 48 hours before we actually had rain, which is highly unlikely, highly unusual, but the temperatures were also up to the over the 50 mark. So we registered 54.4 on our met stations, and that's pretty hot. That's in Celsius. So the normal thermometers bust at 50, the alcohol thermometers, and, you know, mass produced at 50 C. So out at Burke, they would have been absolutely of no use unless they're in the refrigerator. So, yeah, we'd been there 6 years before, and at the same time, and we'd driven back through floodwaters, and this time I drove down to Tasmania and helped put out the fires down in Tasmania as well. So, and it's just all done by donation, and people have been throwing a little bit of money at us to put petrol in the tank and go out and either help fight fires or bring rain into desolate areas for farmers to get a crop in and fill the dams up. So we're happy to do it.
Well, so how long have you actually been going around doing this?
I started back in 85 with Jack Toyer, but on basically full-time since 2006. So we put it away for 12 years. By the way, there was a 12-year drought. So I got encouraged to maybe try and trick it and get it to rain again. So we did right through central Queensland and up into the Northern Territory. We had it rain in the middle of the dry and busted 132-year-old rainfall records and things like that, because it normally doesn't rain in the dry in the Northern Territory. So a side view of what we were doing caused rain. So it's a nice way
to look at it. Are you able to make other effects other than just rain?
Yes, we are.
So are you able to dry up clouds and make it sunny?
Yeah, we can turn them off. I believe we can even direct a hurricane or a cyclone or unwind it. Tornadoes, all that sort of stuff. But you don't want to be messing with it for too long. Otherwise, you could cause earthquakes or, you know, other things that, you know, come back to kick your butt. So you do it in a very gentle manner and hopefully don't cause too much devastation, to get a little bit of water over your plants and crops and, you know, major national parks, which are leading, like you led to before, about, you know, lots of fire damage because they've cut out the fire trails for four-wheel drive access and things like that for recreation. They used to burn off about every 6 years. Now it's so much low timber and low growth that unless they do burn it off in some aspects, you know, it's going to cause quite a lot of devastation. You know, people live close to the forests and do get burnt. So.
Yeah. I was under the impression that these most recent spate of forest fires have been the worst ever for Australia. Is that about right?
Oh, Vinny, I have no idea. But it could have been because of the amount of foliage that had been available and, you know, leaf litter and so forth. sitting on the ground, you know, branches and timber and so forth, unless it's burned off on a regular basis, you know, the fire gets really hot and burns the trees completely. The other ones just singe and allow the seed pods to germinate. So there's a... the Aboriginals before us had been, you know, going through and lighting fires to keep the animals down and to keep the seeds growing in this light. They weren't serious bushfires. I mean, of course, they would have been in some areas, but lightning strikes and things like that start fires. And I think, you know, they had been burning off in some areas to backburn, you know, against raging fires and things like that, and everything gets out of control. So it's just one of those things where, you know, if you do things in moderation, it's okay. If you do it too excess, well, then it gets out of control.
Kind of like alcoholism. All right. Peter Stevens is my guest, and we'll have him on for one more segment, ladies and gentlemen. So, Peter, just hold on the line there, and we'll talk to you after the break. And also, I wanted to encourage people to donate to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Go to the homepage there and click on the donate button. Or if you'd like to donate regularly, you can click on the subscribe button and send us in a regular donation of between $1, $5, $10, or $20 a month, just to keep, you know, the lights on and the internet bills paid, so I can just keep, you know, kind of doing this radio show for you to listen to. And lastly, there's also a bank account number on there, so if you don't like PayPal, and I know a lot of people don't, you can use that one instead. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, broadcasting live from the other land down under, New Zealand. Apparently it's the seventh state of Australia, according to the Australian Constitution, from mate, what Wayne Levick told me about. And I was just thinking to myself, well, you know what? It doesn't really matter. Nah, seriously. Anybody who thinks they got national sovereignty... they're fucking kidding themselves. There's no such thing. We're all slaves to the Global Scumbaggery Index, all right? It's on the stock market. You can check it out. You know, I don't... let's just say I'm no longer operating under the delusion that I'm free. All right? I have freedom within a certain bounds, and that's it. And it can be taken away at any point by scumbaggery individuals with a gun and a black hockey mask. My very special guest is Peter Stevens, the Cloud Seeder. Welcome back.
Thanks, Vinny. Well, we're not so much cloud seeding as in like using silver iodine, but we use reflected light from the ground. And absolutely amazing.
Right, so the cloud shiner.
Cloud China, yeah. Polisher.
Yeah,
so a lot of fun. The other thing that we've been experimenting with are magnets, and we've actually got the normal opposing magnets coming together, and that's shown some amazing events for helping clean water and things like that. So I'd love to discuss that part of it with you as well.
Shoot, go right ahead.
Okay. Our website's weathercreation.com, and you can actually see some of what we do on that. We've been playing around with water and cleaning up polluted streams. I actually went to Dhaka in Bangladesh last year to assist in the cleaning up of ponds and rivers to help get rid of the pollution out of some of those streams. And absolutely amazing in our lab that we made, clean water within 3 minutes. Absolutely amazing, you know, from putrid soiled water with all sorts of pollution in it, back to a clean, energised water. So quite amazing. Here in Australia, we have problems with some of the wells with very high minerals, and also sitting on contaminated water, either from fracking with you know, the coal seam gas, the way in which they pressurise their wells to fractionate and bring gas in out of different areas, has also started to pollute our groundwater. Well, not started, they're doing a bloody good job of it. But the amazing thing is that it looks like we might be able to help clean it up. I also went to Japan after the tsunami that really hit Japan quite badly, and the whole environment is polluted now through the marine environment all around Fukushima and those areas. But now the US is also looking like it's copped some of the radiation just from the floating debris and stuff like that, and the air particles all coming across. Not that it's a fearful thing, but it's just going to be, somebody said, only 30,000 years to fix it unless we come up with a way of being able to solve it or resolve the use of nuclear radiation the way that it is at the moment. It's quite dangerous. You can't see it, smell it, taste it, but it will bring you and stop you from being able to produce genetically. I'm concerned for the people of Japan in that manner. The avenue of why I went there was that I'd come up with a device that I believe would possibly help, and I ended up being stopped at the airport from taking 7 of the units because of their high magnetic frequency, that I wasn't allowed to take them on the aircraft. So I ended up having to go with just the shells and then get the magnets. Whilst I was in Japan, I was only able to rebuild one of those units, and I ended up giving it to Dr. Amota, who you may be aware of, who does the ice crystals and words and intention on containers beside the water to help clean it up. So I'd heard his prayer and realised that it was quite serious to all of the planet to start to focus on trying to fix this problem. And I think we've got an opportunity to keep doing the research till we get it right. And hopefully our children's children's children have got a place to live, because at this stage it's looking pretty doubtful. But anyway, and without any more doom and gloom, it'd be nice to see if we can actually help the planet. We believe we're helping by bringing rain and or pushing cyclones away normally, or hurricanes. We've seen the opportunity to just bring, you know, a glint in the eye of some farmers that know that it's going to rain and actually trust it, put the seed in the ground and actually get a crop in. So quite amazing events. So the magnetic water is, I believe, one of the most important things. It'll also help desalinate seawater, all sorts of things like that. So we're just in a very fine or small way at the moment, but we'd like to be able to expand that up.
So have you ever thought about getting a job with a chemtrail company?
I think they've got enough going on with the aircraft and the chemicals they're throwing out, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I don't think I'd really fit within their parameters of working. You know, why are they doing it? You know, really, that's the question one should ask. You know, is it to keep the radiation that they've let off in the atmosphere above so that it doesn't come down? You know, that radiation is still up there, guys, you know. It's pretty horrific. So the Nevada test, the Mexico test, New Mexico test, French tests, you know, they were playing around down in New Zealand until such time as they blew up the Rainbow Warrior or something in the harbour, didn't they?
What was interesting when the Rainbow Warrior was blown up, the two French agents who got caught by the New Zealand authorities, we released them after the French threatened to stop importing our lamb's brains or something like that. Apparently they import a frickin' heckload of lamb's brains from New Zealand, so they threatened to stop importing them. So we're like, oh, economic consequences for actually arresting proper criminal terrorists that are working for foreign governments. Let's let them back in. And when they went back to France, they got a hero's welcome and a parade, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, that might be the case, but what their great-grandchildren are going to be living with will be even a better consequence. So, you know, but they get the praise and glory now, but eventually it comes back and kicks their butt. So that's the way I see it. But right at the moment, I'm up on the Gold Coast and, mate, the sun's shining, there's a bit of cloud out there, nothing to do with me, but a lot of fun. And thank you very much for having me on your show, Vinny. It's been absolutely wonderful being able to talk to the people in America and all around the world. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And as I understand it, you don't do this very often.
We probably get out there once every 2 years and let people know what we're doing. We pick a medium, either newspaper or like yourself. This is, I think, the second time on Freedom Radio. So I think the last one was with Dr. David Morton, and that was absolutely fantastic. They had me on there for 2 hours talking. So I could talk for a little bit longer, if you like. But it's just amazing to see some of the inventions and some of the science of what we're doing and how they've developed. I don't bother patenting anything anymore because it's far better to just give it away and pick up the odd donation and say thank you very much, because if you do the business, they'll rip you off anyway and you just don't feel any good when that happens. Your solicitors end up driving Rolls Royces and you're driving just a very cheap old car, clanking, you know. You're just not, you know, focused on the financials where you possibly should be to be able to continue doing what we're doing. But we have a fantastic team, and we've been doing this in groups with my involvement. For instance, with Joe, with the Joe cells, with the water cars, with the water fuel cells for cars and things like that. We've been doing that and gave it away to people all over the world, so that, you know, not that we're fighting against the fuel companies, but just that the environment, the pollution coming out the exhaust needs to be looked at as being clean and green. And that's what I think we're able to do with these fuel cells or the Joe cells. It helps clean up. It also gives you a lot better fuel economy. And if people are interested in that, they could have a look at Joe cells on the internet and see what we've done. There's quite a few videos on the YouTube as well.
So what's that?
Just amazing.
What's that website for the cells then?
Well, go back through the weathercreation.com and there's a few there. But the website that's used is just generally a Yahoo group called Joe Cells 2. And it's available to look at, and there are lots of discussion and people are trying to do it and, you know, all the problems associated with it. But there are lots of photos of exactly how to do it and follow it through. I'm called Inventor, INGVENTOR. So I'm an inventor of all sorts of ings, which is why I picked up that handle. But it's just exciting to look at some of the technology that we've found, including the magnets, which are amazing. I just love playing with them. It's got them clanging apart and firing together. And I've even got one that flies. So I've got the fields that are normally what we refer to as axial or diametrical. And I've got magnetic fields that, as they cross the path, they actually fly away. So exciting stuff. I think, you know, over the next 30 years, we'll see lots of this technology that we were told didn't exist. The quantum physics and all that sort of thing, you know, the mind becoming more and more powerful and more accepted within society. So the Mendeleev periodic tables of 1901, I think, really need to be supplanted by Dr. Walter Russell's of 1921 and ongoing research that he did in the spiral form of all of nature, including the subatomic and the atomic particles. He was the one who found, it was called a different name, but he found the tritium and deuteriums, the hydrogen isotopes and things like that. And the way in which he did that, he just did reflective sound waves and counted the number of charges and things like that associated with it, and realized that there were elements at that stage that were unknown. And he just wrote on the periodic tables, unknown, which is just beautiful. So he did a lot of work with Westinghouse's laboratory as well, and some purporting of him making 17 different elements out of water. So all things come from water and go back into it. So that's the exciting thing to sort of be aware of, is that...
And you happen to be...
on pressure.
And you happen to be in a position where you can create water.
Yeah, funny about that. Well, the water's already there. We're not creating it. We're just directing it over a certain area to rain. The biggest problem is, in a lot of ways, is that we've gone with deforestation, taking a lot of trees and other areas out, and then we've put water into stagnant ponds called dams because we as humans need it. But a lot of the water actually needs to be moving in through the environment, through trees and plants and, you know, exhalation of, you know, all beings being able to breathe in and out with a certain amount of moisture in the atmosphere. If we keep locking it up in dams, it's no longer in the atmosphere, and therefore we're changing the environment of the planet, and the weight of the water also on the plate tectonics could also be causing other devastating events. But, I mean, that's hypothetical for me, but it's just a possibility that that may be one of the causes. If we keep putting masses of weight of water on the planet, we could actually tip it over in one way. So we could change what the pole is now, north and south. Antarctica, for instance, could come back and be Atlantis again. You know, how fantastic would that be? So, you know, if we keep damming the water, we might end up tipping the planet over, which in some ways, you know, might be a good thing. Old Mother Shipton might be right. Mother Shipton was the prophetess from the 14th century or 15th century. Exciting stuff that she forecast we would be able to do in these times. Mm-hmm. So you have to be aware of the cause and consequences.
Yeah, nobody ever said playing God was a risk-free business.
Well, not so much playing God, but he sits down with us a fair bit and gives us a bit of a chat.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we've come to the end of this interview. Now we've got another 30 seconds or so. So, Peter Stevens, ladies and gentlemen, you can go see his website. Is it weathercreations.com with an S or just weathercreation?
No, without. Just weathercreation without an S on
theweather.com. Right.
And we'll look forward to seeing you come by. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, mate. And I guess we'll keep watching the skies, eh?
Yeah, anytime you like. We can bring a bit of snow to New Zealand, no doubt.
Yeah.
It's always good snow. Skiing over there.
Preferably not. I frickin' hate the cold. I hate it. You
know? Well, come to the back of Earth.
Yeah. Well, I flattered down in Dunedin, bro, and I watched my olive oil freeze at room temperature. Never again.
Fantastic talking with you there. Thanks, Benny.
Cheers, Peter. Have a good day, mate. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the show that's all about genocide and scumbaggery and laughing at it, because if you don't, you'll go absolutely, completely and utterly insane. Oh, yeah. Broadcasting live 5 days a week on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And my very special guest right at this moment is Brian Strom. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinny. How you doing?
Yeah, somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Thanks for having me on your show.
You're welcome, mate. Now, you're a bit of an inventor yourself, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I hold patents on a specialized type of advanced DC generators. It uses standard induction, but in a radical new geometry. I spent about...
What exactly is a DC generator? Is it something that politicians use in the Washington Monument or something?
Yeah, maybe they should. Well, it could be an AC generator as well. It's an induction type generator. I prefer the DC embodiment to the AC embodiment. It's going to be more efficient. But an AC version could be built, and it would be an extremely high efficiency generator, beyond what is typically considered 100%.
You know, I think you could probably do an ad for that and have a theme song from maybe AC/DC.
Right. They were onto something.
So what exactly are you generating? How does it work? You know, pretend that I know nothing. Actually, don't pretend.
Well, most generators built in the 20th century, of course, are AC-type induction generators, mostly developed by Nikola Tesla. Edison later, glommed onto his technologies and distributed them, and with the help of, Morgan, developed the AC industries here in the United States, leading also around the world. But those induction generators have a cap of efficiency, and it's based on what's called Lenz's law, or the law that basically regulates through those machines the transfer of mechanical energy in terms of rotating torque, velocity and torque of rotation, into electricity. And they're capped by Lenz's law, which is a law which I spent more than a decade researching to identify its weaknesses, essentially. Then through the result of that research, I've come across designs of generators built in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and I met with several of those inventors. Adam Trombley, I spent a number of hundreds of hours with personally, actually. Met him at a free energy conference in Hanover, West Germany in 1988, where he was a keynote speaker. At that conference, there was literally about a dozen devices that all claimed to be over 100% efficient. I'd say 80% of those devices were in the field of frictional heaters and anomalous heating units that produce more heat than they were supposed to, through the conventional wisdom. So, I attended that conference then. I met Adam Trombley there, and he took me into the area of his research, which was that of the unipolar generator. The unipolar generator is the simplest known generator. It's been known about since Michael Faraday himself in 1871, I think it was. He built a type of Faraday disc and experimented in his notes with versions of the unipolar generator. Now, the unipolar generator is simply a magnetic disc or sphere that's spinning on its axis of magnetization. It's exactly the same as the Earth itself. The Earth has a magnetic field that is essentially along its line of axis of rotation, and it spins in the presence of its own field. This presents a lot of kind of problems to orthodox physicists. A lot of them want to say that this won't even work because there's no relative motion between the rotor and the field source. And the reality is it does work. It works very well. It's been identified in the American Journal of Physics and other technical references. The one-piece generator is a reality, and you can spin a disk that supplies its own magnetic field in the presence of its own field and generate a voltage from it, and current, and quite a lot of current, actually. So I hope that wasn't too technical or stuff, but I'll go along with that if you like.
Keep going, man. Keep going.
Well, okay. So the unipolar generators, based on the geometry and magnetism of the Earth itself, you know, to a great respect, it forces a lot of thought into how does this really happen, and the devices I've built that prove out this philosophy and theory is that the magnet itself, a permanent magnet, is just like an optical lens. Yeah, it's like a lens in the respect that when you look through a lens, you see an image on the other side. But if you rotate the lens on its axis of focus, the image that you see does not rotate. Just the lens rotates in its own focal paradigm or, you know, event. And so when a magnet similarly is rotated on its axis of field, assuming you've got, you know, a symmetrical disc-shaped or cylindrical magnet that's magnetized down the length of its geometry with symmetry, you know, all around, and it's spinning on that same symmetrical axis of field, the field doesn't rotate. And so the objects that are spinning around in that field are essentially moving through the field are getting induced to have a polarity just by virtue of spinning in the presence of its own field. And it's just the same amount of induction as occurs in all the other AC, you know, Tesla-type generators and even, you know, DC motors and generators. But it's a different geometry than is typically taught or accepted, acknowledged. These generators, versions of them have been around in industry for a long time. A homopolar generator is slightly different from a unipolar generator in that a homopolar generator has a fixed field source and a disk or inductor rotating in front of it. So there is a relative motion between the two objects in a homopolar generator. And my designs are a combination of those two events. I've got two counter-rotating disks spinning in the presence of a common field that's also aligned with the axis of rotation. There's no interference with it. I built
such
it's a kind prototype...
Is it by chance similar to the way a... A flying saucer is supposed to work with spinning discs, and it creates a magnetic field, and it allows it to kind of push through and move around space with no G-force kind of thing?
Well, sort of, yes. I found some interesting references that do correlate the geometries. There was a sort of famous or infamous, if you will, inventor in England in the 1970s named John Searle, and built a thing called the Searle disc that was apparently a magnetized disc that he'd spin at a high rate of speed, and smaller models of it, it would levitate off the ground, turn blue, luminous blue, and then disappear on its own. And then he supposedly built a large model of this that you could get inside. And so I couldn't find that many details on John Searle and his work, but there were similarities in some of the devices I heard he tested. And there is a kind of runaway effect that occurs with the unipolar and homopolar generators. Since there's a charge...
Well, if you were using that to perhaps generate electricity, wouldn't you worry that, you know, your generator might just up and disappear one day?
Well, yeah, that would be a challenge. Yeah.
It's like, dude, the power's out. Go check the generator. It's gone.
Well, I don't want to build, you know, my goal is not to build something that has any runaway type effect or is in any way harmful either. My goal is simply to build a better generator, if you will, better mousetrap, one that utilizes induction, but it also utilizes these new high-tech rare earth permanent magnets, which are fairly available. Actually, the magnet technology of the neodymium magnets was invented here in Indiana, where I'm from, through a joint venture between General Motors Corporation and the Chinese government. And that was in a company called MagnaQuench that they have since dismantled and swept under the rug. GM fought China on the rights to those magnets and lost. And basically, China sells them to whoever they want to. They mine most of the neodymium in the world anyway and control basically the whole market on those magnets.
Mm. There's actually a place here in New Zealand where they've got where they sell neodymium and magnets there, and they have this the steel grate on the floor that's held to the floor just with one little neodymium magnet. And if you can manage to move the grate at all, you get like $1,000 or something like that. Nobody's been able to move it.
Well, yeah, I'm still working with some that are about 10 years old, and they've got about an 800-pound force of attraction between a couple of them. But I know that now they can make them probably about twice that strong, like up to 60. I think they have an N60 these days, which is just incredible material, space-age material. They can hold that level of field, you know, and retain stability. The instable part of the neodymiums is that they can't hold temperature. If you heat them up even to the point of boiling water, they'll lose almost all their field.
Is that about the weakness of them?
That's one of the greatest weaknesses, yeah, to them is temperature.
Okay. Well, maybe if I go down to that place who has the neodymium thing and pour some boiling water on that magnet, then try and move it, I could be $1,000 richer.
There you go. Take some boiling hot coffee and spill it on
that sheet. There you go. Oops!
And it would demagnetize it, yeah, right quickly.
All right. There's a money-making venture. Thank you. Suss that out after the show. I've also got to ask as well, in layman's terms, how exactly do these devices work, and how much energy are they really generating? I mean, how big is it? Could you power a house on it? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, eventually, yes. That's the goal, is to build, you know, larger scale devices. Now, the prototypes I work with, I've got a 4.5-inch diameter rotor right now. I'm moving my next prototypes go up to a 6-inch diameter neodymium magnet, which has got a lot of field strength, you know, and it's going to easily produce as much power as that of a car battery. And that's sort of the equivalent I'm shooting for, something about 12 volts DC at about 100 amps continuous available. And the machine, the way it would operate in an ideal embodiment, it would have a computer control system, and it needs a starter motor, too. Because it doesn't do anything while it's sitting still, so you have to spin it up to speed, at which point you have to put a load on it, electric load, which excites the coils in it, where they actually attract each other, and will develop additional torque under an electric load, which is contrary to that which is taught in physics and textbooks that, of course, if you put electric load on a normal generator, it creates a braking force inside the generator, which slows it down. And in mine, I've got two field sources set up in a tangential arrangement where when a load is put on them, the resultant fields are an attraction to each other. It's a redesign of these systems, and one which may actually produce a usable torque and power simultaneously. But the electric load would have to be computer controlled, and the velocity of the machine would have to be regulated by a little piggyback control system.
Okay, so you kind of didn't answer my question, but how big is it, and what could you run off? I mean, like in an ideal world, let's say you get all the designs and all the kinks worked out, what would you really be looking at producing?
Because what I'd really love to have is a portable generator that kind of runs on its own. You don't need to refuel it, don't need to recharge it or anything like that. And you can just basically bring it anywhere. You can power a campsite, or you can just plug it into the mains power of your house and power that and sell power back to the grid if you want to. Is it anything like that?
Very, very nice, yes. Yeah, so in an ideal world, you know, at the 6-inch diameter rotor, it's going to fit inside basically kind of a car battery is what, about 12 inches by 6 or 7 inches by 7 or 8 inches or so, right? So it should fit inside. It should be actually smaller than a car battery, lighter than a car battery, produce the same output as a car battery. In these earlier embodiments. Now, maybe there could be ways to pack it even more energy dense than that as we go, but in early embodiments, that's what I would shoot for. So to power a house, you probably need one that was about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet.
All right, hold on. Hold it right there. We'll be right back after the break. Just hold on the line. Ladies and gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment today. We've got my very special guest, Brian Strom, who's the inventor of basically kind of free energy technology. Really, welcome back to the show, Brian.
Thank you.
How long have you been doing this?
I started my studies in the mid 1980s. Actually, 1988 was a pivotal year. I went to the Hans Kneipper Free Energy Conference in West Germany, and there I met Dr. Adam Trombley, who introduced me to the unipolar technology. It took me long. It's taken, you know, many years, and it's ongoing to get the resources together to build the ongoing prototypes. But I'd built about 10 or 12 solid devices that just prove or disprove various principles as I progressed.
Now, speaking of principles, have you had any roadblocks that you've been hit into from other people trying to stop you doing your research, or suppression syndrome, any of that kind of stuff going on, or has pretty much everybody just left you alone?
I have made presentations to some larger organizations, especially here in Indiana, including Rose Holman Ventures, which is highly capitalized, and including the Indiana Venture Center, which is a business development incubator, and let's see, also to Delco Remy America, which used to make all the alternators and generators for all GM cars. Now they're an independent company, really, doing it for the whole industry, but with competition. Mostly, I would say the forces against me are simply personal forces of maintaining their own jobs or status or the ideas that they have been taught. I go a little further than the most people in this area of science. So I could be seen as a threat. You know, I don't think anything directly has come after me, but I'm on my guard.
Well, there's also another element to this, is that people just don't believe that it's even possible, or they just don't understand the science behind it, and therefore they just instantly lose interest and say, oh, it's quackery. Like a friend of mine, we ordered these hydrogen fuel cells online and got them in.
installed it in the car ourselves. Worked great, you know, when we were driving in the city, about maybe 10% extra fuel economy, but a massive increase in power to the car. And when driving open road, that's when the fuel economy just went through the roof. You know, we got nearly twice as far as we normally would on a single tank of gas.
And so you're adding hydrogen to the gasoline?
Brown's gas, directly into the carburetor kind of thing.
Brown's gas, yes. Well, I'm very familiar with Brown's gas. It's fantastic.
I met
Neil Brown. I met him and bought two of his machines from him personally. Around 1995.
Well, what was interesting and what I was trying to elaborate on here was that my friend was a mechanic, right? So he was talking to his other mechanic buddies in the shop, and they all said, "Oh, that's dangerous. It'll blow up, or it'll overheat the engine, and this kind of thing." They don't know that it burns cool, kind of thing. They're just basically idiots who don't know what the hell they're talking about, and because they don't know what the hell they're talking about, they don't want to do it.
Right, right. Brown's gas is counterintuitive, absolutely. There's an implosive gas, not an explosive one, and that aspect alone is very difficult to convey, you know, to other scientists. Ewell himself demonstrated to me, he had a bucket, like a 5-gallon bucket filled with water, and then a coffee can inside there, and he pushed the coffee down and filled all the way up with water, and then turned it upside down and pull it up in the air so it was filled with water. Then he'd take it had a spark igniter on it too, like a grill spark igniter on the bottom of the can, and then he'd fill the can up just with the Brown's gas through a tube underwater. So that you knew that there was just Brown's gas inside that coffee can. And then he'd ignite it, you know, and everyone would think his hydrogen's going to explode, right? And no, it didn't explode at all. It made a kind of a whoosh-whack sound as it created a vacuum inside the coffee can, and the water slapped up to the top of the can. Remarkable demonstration. Yeah, the Brown's gas is implosive. Yeah.
A friend of mine, John Eisen, in fact, he does this magazine, Uncensored Magazine, available if anybody is keen, from uncensored.co.nz. It might be coming into the States and Europe soon. He had a hydrogen cell similar to mine, a little larger, a lot more panels on it. And he accidentally left it running one day, you know, like he had to unhook the battery in order to turn it off, and he forgot. And so this Brown's gas just kept building up and building up and building up, and then he was just sitting inside, you know, working on his computer, and then bang, you know. Oh, my God. And you know, what was surprising is that it didn't cause a fire. It didn't do anything. It was just a little bit of an implosion, and it didn't even damage the cell itself. It just kind of blew out a little bit of a gasket on his car. And that's just because it was building up continuously and wasn't able to release.
Inside the car?
Yeah, into the carburetor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? It doesn't explode, it actually implodes. And Ewell was working, he was right, running his Brown's gas straight into some crude oil, and he was running the crude oil through a closed loop, around in a closed loop, and at one end of the loop he'd put the Brown's gas, mix it with the crude oil, and the other end of the loop he had a piston engine that ran on crude oil, and he could run the same crude oil through the piston engine endlessly just by adding hydrogen to it with the Brown's gas.
I think that there's really a lot to be said for these types of technologies, and what I find really frustrating is that, well, let me put it this way. Somebody questioned whether I was paying some, I forget what it was, I used to be a smoker, right, and somebody criticized me and said, "Oh, you're supporting big tobacco," and I said, "Really? How did you get here?" And they go, "Well, I drove." And I go, "Really? Did you by chance fill your car up at some giant mega death oil corporation on your way here?" "Yeah." "Well, then you're supporting big oil." And you know, it's just the point that just because you don't have a choice, really, And in order to do it yourself requires a lot of time and energy, and people just don't want to do it. It's really strange.
Yeah, they don't. Right. Some people, I think, are fearful of the kind of change and whatnot, you know. So it's going to take probably people just like you and I who, you know, get things going on our own and distribute it, you know, among a small group of people. I mean, that's, we have to at least, you know, distribute the information right now. I mean, I have no fear of discussing my technology openly. I mean, there are some intricacies in the design work which are pretty special. I don't really disclose those, but, you know, otherwise the basic premise of it is public domain, has been for a long time. You know, the new work that's going on in the electric universe, scientific worlds, I believe Thunderbolts.info is a great organization, and they're really promoting, you know, the new beliefs about the electromagnetic universe, you know, to the orthodox community. I've approached them about my technology, and they're still not so receptive to it. You know, they'd actually never even responded, because for them, I probably address too many issues too fast, and they don't want to hit it that hard. You know, they just want to chip away at the old thing. Whereas I think guys like you and I, we just want to wipe the slate clean and start over again.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm actually inherently a lazy consumer. So I'm being pretty blunt and honest here. What I want, really, is something on the market that I can purchase and have somebody install it for me. And if something goes wrong with it, have somebody maintain it for me, you know, either at a warranty or a small cost or something like that, and conveniently fit it into the consumer model. The difficulty is actually finding people who will be willing to do that. And I don't know, it's really sad. And unfortunately, we've come to the end of the program here, Brian. Do you by chance have a website or anything like that people can visit if they want to read up more?
I appreciate that. Yes, I have a small website presence at magvortex.com. That's magvortex.com. And it has a couple little clips, but it also should have my patent documents and some numerous supporting technical documents and some images of some of my prototypes. I appreciate the time. Thanks for having me on the show, Vinny.
You're welcome, mate. I mean, today's been a very interesting show nonetheless. We've had three people talking about radically different subjects. One about his pigs not being able to be sold and sort of food control and Agenda 21 in the United States. Another guy who's who is able to create rain in Australia. And then we've got you, who's able to create energy out of magnet technology and stuff in the United States. So, and on the host from New Zealand. So there we go. This is a nice little variable show for you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope all of you can listen into it a little more regularly, because, mate, every single day we've got somebody new on this show, pretty much, all right? So I encourage people to go into those archives at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, and if you like it, enjoy it, and please make a donation if you can. We'll see you again sometime.